Blogging the Boys presents Cowboys Radio with Rabs and McCool. Here are your hosts, Rabble Rouser and Landon McCool.
Hello, howdy, and welcome to another edition of Blogging the Boys Cowboys Radio. I'm Landon McCool, and with me, as always, is Rabble Rouser. Rabble, it's not going so well so far. How are you doing?
I'm hanging in there, man. I'm hanging in there. You know, they've lost three in a row, which is the longest losing streak in the Jason Garrett administration. Although he took the mantle to the throne, you know, after a similar losing streak. So he's been here for this kind of streak. You know, I tell you why I'm hanging in there, because there have been a lot of interesting developments of late, both during the Patriots game and immediately thereafter. And so the horizon, it may not even be hopeful, frankly, but at least it's going to be interesting. And I think that's important because, you know, you and I spent a lot of time talking during camp and hanging out during camp. And you probably got very tired of me saying that the Oxnard sojourn 2015 just wasn't that interesting to me. And I think one of the reasons why is because, and we talked about this at great length, both, you know, you and I together and on the podcast from that period of time, that, you know, if we even flash back to the 2014 camp, you know, there was the, is Romo going to be okay? You know, are they going to be able to assemble some semblance of a running game? Can DeMarco Murray stay healthy? Is Jason Garrett on the hot seat? What's going on with the entire coaching staff? Because they are, you know, at the end of their contracts, is this whole Kiffinelli 4-3 defense even a good idea? Has the league passed it by? Who's going to start at right guard? You know, there were all these kind of questions. And that keeps camp interesting. That keeps following the team interesting. And this year, none of those questions were really pertinent. You know, you and I talked about this. If there are, let's say, 26 starters, let's say now with, you know, with the, now that we are in the substitution era in the NFL, each team has roughly 25, 26 starters. And then we probably knew 24 or maybe even 25 of those starters at the beginning of camp. There was nothing that was really a surprise. And so, you know, that was good because one of the reasons why there were a few surprises is because this roster is really strong and this roster is young, but, you know, sort of locked into place. And those are good things. It's not that those are bad things. It's just that it wasn't that interesting to watch that process because it was the continuity was leading to a lot more of the same. And so from that particular point of view, there's going to be a lot of new developments here. There are going to be new people starting. There are going to be, you know, changes at certain positions. And I think that at the very least, while it may not be hopeful, will be interesting. And that at least makes me happy.
Yeah, and the shakeup is, you know, is coming in a couple of different positions. We'll talk about it too because it is important. And but at the very least, it gives us. I think hope gets lost when, you know, there's nothing on the horizon to look forward to.
Exactly.
We're not there at all. I mean, first of all, Romo and Dez are coming back. And second of all, you know, it's really just about not even the bad situation that we're currently going through is going to be the same after the bye. So, you know, not only is change coming, it's coming in stages quickly, intermediately, and in the long term. So, all right. But speaking of the short term, what's going on with the show today?
Well, I think we're going to have a good show. We're going to spend the bulk of it in having a nice, long, stats-driven chat with BTB's resident stat cyborg, OCC, also known as One Cool Customer, also known as The Goog. And so he's going to give us some kind of statistical insight on the state of the Cowboys after the first five games. And we'll also compare the 2005 iteration of the Cowboys to the 2014 model to try to get a little bit of perspective on what the differences might be.
All right, so we definitely need to talk about some of the stuff that happened in the Patriots game, and then some of the fallout from the huge loss. You know, obviously, I think we were both very disappointed with the outcome of the score and with how the offense played. So I'd like to kind of just generally talk about what happened in the game, and then let's focus on some of the different things that happened in the game that might affect the team moving forward. So what are your, first of all, just your general thoughts of the game overall?
Well, you know, you were just saying that you were disappointed in the game, and honestly, I don't know that I was. I didn't think they had a.
Well,
a
I was print. Disappointed in the score, but yes, yeah. Not in the game.
But you know, the funny thing about that is the score looks like it was a beatdown. Yes. 30-6 seems like it was a beatdown. It didn't feel like a 30-6 game. It didn't feel like that dominant of a performance on the part of the Patriots. I felt like they got a couple of. They got several easy scores on short fields. They got a long touchdown on a pick play that was probably illegal. I don't know. I didn't feel like the Cowboys just got beaten.
No, they didn't. It actually looked a lot like what I thought we talked about. Like, you know, that could happen. You know, where the defense bared down. They got pressure on Brady. They rattled him early. We talked about that, you know, that stat where I think, you know, if he gets hit more than two times in the first half, that you know they actually have a losing record. I mean, it all looked like it was going great early on, except for the fact that, and this, you know, obviously was what was the nail in the coffin for Brandon Weeden, is that we just couldn't score. We couldn't put the ball in the end zone. We had opportunities galore, and we couldn't put the ball in the end zone. And I think that ultimately, like I said, was kind of the last straw for Weeden. And it wasn't like he was terrible at points. He was bad at points all throughout his starting period. But the Patriots, he was just consistently not, you know, afraid to push the ball downfield. And again, like, I think I feel for him because I feel like part of it is that, you know, they game planned him to have a short passing game, and they game planned him. They set him up to say, okay, this is, you know, we're going to protect Brandon Weeden. We're not going to make him throw the ball down the field. And you know, we're trying to set him up with easy throws and play action and use the run game. And when that didn't work and they had to adjust the game plan for trying to get him to throw the ball down the field so that he could, you know, get some space underneath for his defense, for his offense to work, you know, he wasn't able to do it because he's a backup quarterback who is not, you know, I guess, capable of adjusting to the game plan in the middle of the game really well. Or just in general, he just didn't look comfortable throwing down the field. And I think ultimately the Cowboys realized, well, we can't win with the game plan that we originally set out for Weeden. And if he can't execute the game plan we need to do, then we need to get somebody else in there.
Yeah, I think we're going to talk in a little bit about who that new somebody might be and what differences, if any, that might contribute to the Cowboys going forward. But so one last thought about that before we turn to the bright spot, which is the defense.
Please.
And that is that, you know, you were saying they couldn't score. And I think the real problem is they couldn't get out from the shadow of their own end zone.
Yeah. You
know, there were so many times where they started, where they took over on their 13, their 14, and would drive, you know, to the 18 and then punt. And so the Patriots had just too many opportunities for short fields. You know, early on, the defense was playing with its hair on fire, and, you know, the Patriots would drive 15 yards and get a score, get a field goal or something. And I think ultimately it's that inability that was really troubling. You know, if they had been able to drive 20 yards, 30 yards, I mean, we don't expect Brandon Weeden to drive 90 yards against the Patriots, but if he could have even driven 20 yards or navigated a couple of first downs and, you know, switch field position, the defense might have actually had a chance to do something. But it just, you know, they got no help at all. But let's talk about that defense. So obviously one of the things that I think, you know, we all latched onto most, especially anybody who loves the kind of X's and O's part of the game, was this new defensive wrinkle. The you know, we can call it the 3-2 dime. It was a 3-2-6 essentially, but there were some really interesting aspects to it. So I'd love to hear, you're a tape head. What were your thoughts about the unveiling of this defense? Which, you know, I think it's important to say, you and I attended a lot of training camp practices. We never saw anything like this at camp. So this was something that they'd been working on in secret and unveiled for this game. And I, you know, I've talked to several people and nobody recalls having seen anything like this before. So what were your thoughts about this? And what are your thoughts about the 3-2-6 going forward?
Okay, so I'm going to ask you to put on your tinfoil hat with me real quick.
Okay.
You remember, and I'm sure anyone who follows me on Twitter remembers, when we would talk about when we signed Dakota Watson from the Jaguars last year, there was talk about us possibly auditioning a position of called the auto linebacker.
Yes.
I kind of think that what Rolando McClain was doing in the 3-2-6 may have been the closest to what I think they wanted to do with that. I think this what they ended up using McClain for was a versatile piece to confuse Brady, because he basically looked like he was coming on every play when he was in there. Mm-hmm. And then would either peel out into coverage, would actually do the blitz, or, you know, would kind of hesitate, maybe see what's, you know, I can't remember exactly what they call that technique, but when you basically wait to see what the running back does, you kind of shadow the running back, see if he blocks, or see if he goes out into coverage. Mm-hmm. And what it did is it allowed – it was definitely a look that Brady had probably never seen Cowboys in, and because of that. They obviously, like you're right, had been working on this formation kind of in secret, you know, in the practices that the media's not at. Because there really was – I mean, we hadn't heard anything about this. And honestly, like – Like I said, the auto experimentation was the only thing that I've heard that could come close to this. And in fact, I think pretty much the reason I gave up on the auto thing is because people eventually did convince me that Marinelli is just too kind of traditional with his formations to do something like this. And so I think it really threw them for a loop at first, because they didn't know what the hell was going on. I mean, and the matchups it created on the outside, and I think what really made it work is that you were getting pass rush from Hardy, because he was able to kind of widen out without a tight end in there and just still be able to take the tackle one-on-one and not have to get the guards involved. And I think the guards were confused about exactly what they were going to do, I think they took advantage. What they saw is that they saw that the Patriots had a young center and two young guards. Mm-hmm. And I think they wanted to take advantage of that by, you know, putting a guy, their best interior pass rusher, heads up on the center, and then basically confusing the other two guards by, you know, making it seem like both Lee and McClain were coming on A-gap blitzes. And sometimes they were. And I think it was enough that the offensive line struggled with the pickups, and that, you know, threw Brady for a whack, and it threw them off kilter, and it really did a good job of putting the Patriots' offense off balance.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a couple things to add to that. You know, if you'll notice, if you watch the game, that first drive, it was really important, I believe, that the Cowboys blitzed both Lee and McClain early in that first series.
Yes.
Because what they needed to do was to show the Patriots that they were willing to send both those guys.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason being that meant that because Tyrone Crawford, who is, as you just said, their best interior rusher, was basically heads up over the center, that meant that the guards had these two guys, which also meant that there was potentially five rushers, which then also meant that the left tackle was going to be one-on-one mm-hmm. with Hardy. And so basically what this particular alignment did was it guaranteed that Hardy wouldn't be double-teamed unless they wanted to keep one of their tight ends, i.e. their most troubling receiving threat, in the game to help block Hardy.
Exactly.
And so, you know, so Nate Solder, who is, a solid NFL left tackle, came out in Tyron Smith's class. So it was like the fourth, I think, tackle drafted in one of the richest offensive tackle first rounds in recent memory.
Mm-hmm.
Very solid player. He's acquitted himself very well. And it was clear he could not. He simply didn't have the tools to stop Hardy. He couldn't do anything.
Well, Hardy literally ripped his bicep off.
As I said on Twitter, it was the Hardy effect. And it's not the last time we're going to see this happen.
No.
So there were several really important things that were accomplished here. But I also will say that there's no way – well, I guess the question is – let me take a step back. The question is, and I think this is a question for all of us going forward, is this something that they concocted just for the Patriots, or is this something that they are going to return to with some frequency going forward? And the reason we don't know that is because it was unveiled during the Patriots. And the reason it was unveiled during the Patriots game, I believe, is not only because I think it's an interesting scheme to confuse – the offensive line for all the reasons that you articulated, but then also obviously this thing does not work for a second without 55 and 76 in there.
Absolutely not. Absolutely
not. So imagine the same schema with Anthony Hitchens there instead of Orlando McClain.
I don't want to imagine that.
And the Patriots are going to take one look at that and say, all right, no problem. We're just going to go heavy and bring LeGarrette Blount in and run it right down Anthony Hitchens' throat, and they're going to just, you know, spend the whole game running for 6 or 7 yards between the tackles.
Even Sean Lee, the only reason Sean Lee could handle, I think, that is because he's a special player. I mean, he's not especially physical like McClain. You know, he's much better as a – he can't shed, there's no doubt, but he's more of a run-and-hit guy.
Absolutely.
So I think just because he's a special guy, he can do this, but – Yeah, no, so my point being, much less, I would much less, you know, not want to have Hitchens in there, because it's what they're doing is basically blitzing between, you know, two pretty beefy guards who are ready to just crush him, and McClain's not afraid of them at all. I mean, you know, but Lee, he's using, you know, moxie and his quickness to get past. He's not using his strength, you know. So.
But the thing about this defense can, I mean, I think ultimately one of the ways the Patriots got the – there are sort of two things the Patriots did to counter this, and one of them was to line Gronkowski or another tight end up next to the left tackle. And so for the better part of the second half, Hardy was double-teamed. Mm-hmm. And the other thing was to go heavy and run at this defense, because this defense is a little bit vulnerable inside with two linebackers over the guards.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not as vulnerable as it might be with a different combination of linebackers. And so, you know, in a sense – Rolando McClain and his physicality and his size gives you another defensive tackle. He's capable of being a stand-up defensive tackle.
Yeah, essentially.
You know, and so this is one of the intriguing storylines that I said earlier in our conversation that I'm interested in following, because I'm wondering, was this a one-off against the Patriots, or is this something, an alignment they're going to go to every once in a while to kind of you know, confused rival offensive lines. Certainly the Giants are going to have to go to the film and prepare for it.
Yeah.
How can that hurt?
That can, especially in a short week. And I'll tell you another thing, too, is that if Marinelli wanted to have a specific schema that he could blitz effectively from, this would be perfect for that. Because you got two guys who can do, you know, some A-gap blitzes. You have a couple extra DBs, guys who are really good at blitzing who could come in. Like I think we saw Corey White blitz on one of these packages. I think you could easily send Byron Jones if there's not like a tight end threat out there. You could send him in a blitz. I think if you want to have a package. You know, and that's, you don't have to have your whole defense be, you know, complicated blitzes. You could still be Rod Marinelli defense, but if you wanted that, you know, like if it's third down and you needed that package of where you wanted to give the quarterback a difficult look, this provides you that option. But I totally 100% agree that I would not trust this package without, and I won't say just without 76, because I'd be okay with 94 possibly running it, but maybe not as much because they may run at it. But I think without an elite defensive end who could really cause an offensive tackle trouble one on one, and without McClain specifically or maybe Jamie Collins could do it. You know, big, physical, but also athletic and fast, who can drop into coverage, middle linebacker who can shoot the A-gaps like that effectively, consistently, that scheme probably wouldn't be nearly as effective.
Right, right. So one of the things you said a second ago, I think is worth discussing further, which is that not only were they able to shoot linebackers in the A-gaps, but in some ways what this also resulted in, was that they went heavy in terms of their defensive backs. You know, so one of the things that the Cowboys did in the offseason was add the two guys who you've just mentioned, Byron Jones and Corey White, both of whom were 6 feet, 6'1", both of them were about 205. And in a sense, they're both built like safeties, but they can play corner. And so if they're going to go in some ways light with the 3-2 part of this, they're going to have to go a little heavier with the 6 part of this. And so one of the other intriguing things going forward is Corey White, you know, because Tyler Patman actually got zero defensive snaps against the Patriots. And in some ways you'd think, well, he'd be a good matchup because they got these little tiny receivers. But what I'm wondering is Corey White's, you know, elevation, quote unquote, to the starting lineup against the Patriots a mark of something they want to do permanently when they just run their base? Or is this part of the package, the 3-2 package? Because Corey White is A, bigger and more able to help against the run, and B, more adept at blitzing. And so one of the things you were talking about was that there were a couple times they brought Corey White off the edge and he blitzed really well. And actually one of those almost would have been a pick six. That would have been, you know, if he hadn't jumped, he probably, you know, if he just, you know, he jumped and then the ball came to him because he was hoping just to you know, interfere mm-hmm. with the I think that the Patriots were running like a little tunnel screen. And, you know, if he had caught that, he would have been gone, obviously. But so the use of Corey White and to some degree Byron Jones in terms of the new defense that includes 76, 55, and as you were saying, 94 is one of the things that I'm really interested in going forward, because I'm wondering, again, is that a one-off, you know, for the Patriots, yeah. or is this a permanent thing, or, you know, how much of what we saw on Sunday is going to be the new program going forward?
A couple of things. One, I think, yeah, you just talked about it. Look how versatile of a 3-2-6 that is. With all those guys that you just mentioned, you can come out in a whole bunch of different looks, because you can do so much with guys like Byron Jones. You can do so much with a guy like Corey White. You can do so much with a guy like Rolando McClain and Sean Lee. Like, these guys are all versatile pieces that can do a lot of different things well. And so what that means is that you can use the same look, but attack the offenses in different ways from that same look, which again is going to give quarterbacks pause and make them have to think about what's going on and make them, you know, make mistakes. And you know, again, Marinelli's defense is not so much about, you know, disguising scheme. I mean, it's never really been about that. It's been more about getting off the ball and getting upfield and you know, twists and stunts, but not really so much about, you know, blitzing. But the point is if he wants to do that stuff, if he wants to give a complicated look, like two or three snaps a game to mix it up, it's just like the idea of zone blocking teams running power encounters, right? It's like you run wide zone left, you run wide zone left, you run wide zone right, you run wide zone left, and then you hit them with a counter play. Mm-hmm. They don't see it coming. It's like that uppercut that, you know, it's the finishing move that where helps you break the big one. And on defense, you know, you're just getting them upfield, getting them upfield, getting them upfield, and then suddenly they come out in this exotic look. You don't know where the guys are coming, and then suddenly you're thrown into, you know, like a robber coverage, and it's an interception. And that's kind of what this can do. And one more thing too, just outside of the 3-2-6, just speaking about Corey White. Even before Skandrick got hurt, I wanted to see opportunities for Corey White to play in the slot. I think Tyler Patman's a fantastic player, and I think he's going to be a great player. And I don't like seeing him not on the field, but I understand why they're doing it with Corey White, because what Corey White can do specifically in the slot as a bigger player gives you so much, you know, versatility, and you get so much use. I mean, now they can't take advantage of a smaller player in the middle of the field. If you got a guy who can capably play the slot at that size, that is such an advantage. I mean, just because, like you said, in the run game, in the blitz game, in coverage on tight ends, now you could possibly put Corey White on a flex tight end who's in the slot. You know, when teams are trying to get tricky, like on like the Philadelphia, maybe you put Corey White out there instead, if Byron Jones isn't on the field and he's in the slot. I just think that there's a lot of scheme versatility to having a larger corner who can play in that nickel back situation.
I agree completely. You know, remember the very first week of training camp, we thought it was sort of interesting that in some ways, you know, you set the tone for the season that first week in terms of like what personnel packages you were working with and what you practice. And they were basically in their nickel alignments on both offense and defense. But the defensive guys were Marinelli and his coaches were working all kinds of interesting blitz combinations. They were, and that's when they first unveiled this this package where Byron Jones and Corey White are basically lined up over tight ends and are playing in the nickel. But then they were blitzing. Sean Lee was blitzing. The other linebackers were blitzing in interesting combinations. So
that was really the closest thing we've seen to that 3-2-6.
Absolutely.
Is when we're seeing Corey White and Byron Jones kind of playing that McClain. Actually, yeah, kind of playing that McClain role where they were lining up in the A gap. And then just, you know, peppering it like they were going to blitz, and then sometimes come in and then sometimes dropping back, sometimes taking the back out, you know, that's really the closest thing we've seen to this, but it still wasn't quite a 3-2-6.
No, I think it was a sort of standard nickel, but with a big corner or safety type as the other linebacker. You're right. He was doing a lot of the same things. You know, the irony of this, of course, is that this kind of multiplicity is exactly what they wanted from Rob Ryan when he was here.
Yeah.
And it's precisely what they decided wasn't going to work because it took too long to teach it and there were too many variables. And so they went away with that from that with Marinelli. And so when you and I observed this at the beginning of training camp and we began to tweet about it and talk about it and stuff, a lot of people said, no.
Yeah,
it's probably a small part of the package for all the reasons you were talking about earlier. No, Marinelli just wants to rush with four. They're not going to become a blitz team. And we were like, well, yeah, but they're playing they're really bringing their men up and playing a lot of press man at the line and stuff. And it seems like, you know, that early stuff that we saw in training camp finally was manifest in the game plan against the Patriots.
Well, I mean, the good news, again, this all goes back to having a simple scheme that is easy to teach so that you can focus on technique, right? When you have the Marinelli scheme, you can spend all training camp working on that technique, working on the, you know, doing it, and that becomes ingrained, right? You don't need to it is important to go back and work on fundamentals, but what you can do is during the week, if you want to install a package like this, this allows you a little bit more time to actually work exclusively on this because the regular portion of your defense is so simplified that you know it to a T to this point. You know what I'm saying? Like, so you, it allows for less time to have to reestablish into that and more time to possibly install something new and knowing that you may only run it, you know, 5, 10, 15 snaps a game.
Yeah, you know, I'm trying to imagine the look in the defensive meeting room when Rod Marinelli and Matt Eberflus stood up for the players and said, "All right, guys, this is what we're going to run this week." They were probably like, "All right."
I kind of wonder how much Eberflus' influence is in on this too, because he's obviously was with Rob Ryan for a long time, so I'm sure he's not uncomfortable with a multiple formation. So I wonder, even though it only put two of his guys in the field, we wouldn't be surprised if his fingerprints were on this.
Yeah, our boy Joey Ikes believes that as well. He thinks that this has some floose, some floose prints on it.
I agree. So let's move to the offense now.
Okay.
And obviously I think, you know, the place where we'll start is with the big news first. Matt Cassel, the new starter for the Dallas Cowboys, is starting this week versus the Giants in New York. And you know what we've discussed is, you know, kind of my feelings on how Whedon is treated, and that's a separate thing than my feelings about how I feel Cassel is gonna perform in this offense. For me, you know, I said it before too. I think Cassel is a much more experienced vet. He's had a lot more success in this league, and you know, not lately. But he has had some success in this league. And I think what you're going to get, not just because of who Cassel is, but also because of what this team has seen and the adjustments they're probably going to make in their game plan, and on top of the fact that, you know, potentially getting Dez Bryant back this week, I think we're going to see much more of a high-variance offense, something, you know, there's going to take more shots down the field. I think Cassel's, you know, as a vet, is going to be more comfortable taking the shots down the field. Cassel's much better anticipation thrower. So I'm hoping that what that means is that he's going to be, you know, throwing the post down the field a little more, you know, getting those kind of stretch the field plays that are timing based a little bit better than Whedon does. Cassel throws a little bit better touch than Whedon too. So, you know, hopefully some of those more difficult seam routes and stuff like that where Whedon's been missing, he can kind of get it in there. But at the same time, what Castle's also going to do is going to put the ball in play for the defense. So that's kind of the give and take there, is that Cassel will throw the ball to the other team. But that's also, you know, what you're asking for when you're asking a non-elite quarterback to throw the ball down the field. You know, it's part of you live and die by the deep ball. And that's what you'll get. So I think that's what I anticipate the change to be as far as for the quarterback position. What are your thoughts? You know, obviously, what do you think the locker room situation is? What are your thoughts on Matt Cassel as quarterback?
Well, you know, you were talking a bit about him and you know what they're going to get from him and what his history is. You know, he's a, what, an 11-year veteran now, I think, in the league.
Right. That sounds right, yeah.
You know, and as you said, he's had success. He's been around. You know, he's thrown a lot of passes and thrown a lot of touchdowns and all that kind of stuff. And actually, you know, his profile fits very nearly what I think the Cowboys – would prefer their backup quarterback profile to be.
It's Kitna-esque, isn't it?
So let's think about the different backup quarterbacks in the Tony Romo era. Ever since, so Tony Romo supplanted Bledsoe in 2006. Bledsoe was the quarterback. Obviously, they got rid of him at the end of that year because he was not happy about that. And so from 2007, which is the Garrett Romo era, they have had, I think, four backup quarterbacks. So the first guy was Brad Johnson. Seasoned veteran, 14-year veteran, had a lot of success for a couple teams, won a Super Bowl with Tampa Bay, had been really good with Norv Turner in Washington for a couple of years. And then, you know, it became clear that his arm was shot, and they got Kitna in. Kitna was here from, I think, 2010 to 2012, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even 2009 to 2012. A couple of those years, Romo played every snap, and the Kitna never had to do anything, so we didn't see as much of him. But he was obviously very, very significant in 2010 when Romo broke his collarbone the first time. Then when Kitna retired, they brought in Orton. And Orton didn't have the same kind of long tenure before he came to the Cowboys, but he had had some success. He had some success with Denver and had a really good season as a rookie with Chicago in 2005. So all of these guys had played between 7 and 14 years. They'd been in the league a long time. They'd seen a lot. And I think the thing that you're talking about in terms of this veteran experience is really important in the sense that they've seen everything defenses can throw at them. You know, there's a certain point when you see everything that defense can throw at you, when you can begin to see what they're doing.
Yeah.
As you're going to the line, you know, and so,
and in the run game too, not just game, like making adjustments, you know, making audibles at the line and adjusting the play, running, not running into the teeth of the defense and making those adjustments.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when Orton and Romo had their little falling out in the quarterback room and Orton had to go, it seemed like they looked around and said, "Oh, there's nobody available who fits that profile. Let's go with this Whedon kid." And it could be that they had a change in philosophy. It could just be that they kind of got caught with their pants down because they were sort of expecting to have Orton for another year or two. I don't know exactly how that worked out, but it does. Whedon presents a very different profile than the backup quarterbacks that they seem to prefer during the Romo era, and I think they prefer them for all the reasons you just talked about, but also because, you know, for the game that Romo gets hurt, let's say he gets knocked out of game, and there's a chance that he'll be back the following week. You know, you want a guy who can walk in there and recognize stuff without having to take a lot of reps in practice. But you also then, if Romo loses, you know, if he's lost for two or three games, you want a guy who can go in there and, you know, defense tries to do stuff and it's not going to confuse him. He'll be like, dude, I saw that in 2007, whatever. I know what to do.
Hmm.
You know, okay. Yeah. Go ahead and try sugaring your blitz. I know how to, you know, look at tape and figure out tendencies because I did that for so many years as a starter. So there are all these things that starters have. They may not have the same arm. They may not have the same physical ability that they once had. Certainly neither Kitna nor Johnson had that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's in terms of recognition, you know, and preparation that they have significant advantages. And so, you know, Whedon has I don't think there's any question Whedon's probably a better athlete at this particular moment, has a better arm than Castle. But it seems like his inability to process information, you know, which led to him making, you know, the most safe choices because he wasn't sure about what he saw sometimes. And I think that that's what we're not going to have with Castle. So that, you know, I think you're right that Castle's more likely to be throwing deep outs but doesn't have the arm to do it. And so, you know, there's going to be vulnerabilities there. But in terms of his ability to process information, which, you know, what Romo said in training camp, this is the thing that I've been gifted with. I can process information quickly. And that happens both through natural gifts, but also through experience. And that I think that's why the Cowboys have always preferred that experienced quarterback, because that guy may not have the arm, but ultimately is quarterbacking about having a strong arm or is it about pattern recognition?
Yeah,
and I think that in terms of the latter, about pattern recognition, Castle gives them an advantage over Whedon.
Yeah, and again, the pre-snap stuff is huge as well too. I mean, going back even further kind of pushing your point, like the pre-snap ability to recognize that, hey, I know what the play is. I know what this defense is. This play isn't going to work. Let's call it to the other side, or let's audible to a pass. I do wonder if they're going to give him more package play opportunities than Whedon, just because of his ability to you know, see all the pre-snap stuff. So, you know, you guys at home, if you start hearing more kills, then we'll know that maybe they gave him more, at least more run pass options, if not, you know, full package plays. So,
so actually one more point about this, which is that, you know, we talk about different schemes and different systems and all that kind of stuff. Oh, it's the West Coast. Oh, it's the Ernie Zan, you know, it's the Don Coryell system. Oh, you know, but the truth of the matter is, offensive football is the same in every system. You might call it different stuff, but the same pass combinations beat the same kind of defenses in every system, right? So it almost doesn't matter who he's played for. If he sees them go in a two deep zone where the corners are trying to funnel everything inside, he knows how to beat that. Yeah. He knows which like high-low combinations beat that, because the same high-low combinations beat that in 2004 that beat that in 2015. And so, you know, we talk about, Castle wants to quote unquote learn the system. And I think he needs to learn the nomenclature, but he's going to go to the line and see what he sees. And he's going to instantly know this is the pass combination that's going to beat that, or this is the one that's not going to work against this. And that's the experience. Now he may throw a duck that gets intercepted, but he'll recognize it instantly. He'll know how to beat it instantly. The body may not be willing, but at least he'll know that. And I'm not sure that Whedon did.
Yeah, and that's really what it is that veterans, you know, to know the offense, you just have to understand the concepts. What are we trying to do to each defense? You know, right. what is the concept of these route combinations? Okay, is this a man beater play? What's going on? And if you're a vet, you understand what offense is trying to do to defenses. And you know, really what it is that you know defenses and you know how to beat those defenses, and you're just learning how this team likes to – what combination of concepts this team likes to use to beat those defenses. And you've already, you know, done all these throws before. It's just about learning the nomenclature, like you said, and then knowing exactly the tools that this offense likes to use to beat the combinations that you've seen time and time again in the past. So
that's right.
Yeah, and I think like you said, the mental part of the game is where you're hoping to gain the advantage with Castle, and really what it is that you have talent even without Dez coming back. You have some talent that you can get the ball to, but it may take a savvy way to get there. It may take, you know, an audible, or it may take, you know, adjustments at the line in order to get the ball to the right players. And Whedon clearly wasn't doing that. So hopefully maybe Castle will start doing that.
That said, I think, you know, and this, you and I have talked about this a lot, it's important that we don't sort of go into this Giants game thinking that suddenly there's going to be an offensive transformation.
Oh, no. Yeah, absolutely. Like,
you know?
Like I said, I've tried to temper expectations, because Castle at the end of the day is still a backup quarterback. You know, he's still like, I mean, this is not, you know, we're not Romo's still not back yet, guys. Like, you know, if anything, like I said, what is making me excited is not so much the arrival of Castle is as much as the arrival of what I assume is a nod to, okay, we're actually going to try and push the ball a little bit. We're going to take more chances, you know, with our backup quarterback, which is, I think, what's necessary. So,
you know, I saw someone, I think it was on Twitter, say that the Castle Whedon debate is akin to the same quarterback debate that's going on in Houston right now. You know, and so in which they're basically, it's a team that has two options, neither of which is actually a particularly viable option, and they're roughly equal. They each present different combinations of strengths and weaknesses, but those weaknesses in many ways outweigh the strengths at this point. And so it's a lose-lose proposition, right? So the head coach in Houston, O'Brien, is screwed either way.
Yeah.
Right. Neither of his guys is the guy that is the kind of guy that's going to win. What you hope is you have a guy who's not going to lose too egregiously, so that, you know, your Clowney and J.J. Watt and, you know, Cushing led defense can win games, etc. So, you know, it's really important for people to realize that Castle's probably not going to be any better than Whedon. He might be different, but he's not necessarily going to be any better.
Yeah. And I think that's really key for people to start to temper their expectations. And if he is better, again, like, we can't stress enough, like, having Dez in the game, you know, makes everybody a better quarterback, you know? So,
And, you know, the thing about this is, you know, Romo's record, I mean, the Cowboys' record in games where Romo was either played the whole game or was healthy in the last year is something like, what is it, like 11-0 or something? I mean, it's ridiculous.
It is.
And Romo's quarterback rating in the last year or so has been at the top of the league. So it's a strong argument can be made that the drop-off here is from the best quarterback in the NFL over the last year and a half to someone who is equivalent to the Houston Texans quarterbacks.
Exactly.
That's a tremendous drop-off. There's nobody that can make
it. At the most important position in all of sports.
Even if they went from, you know, Tony Romo to a solid starter, the drop-off is going to be tremendous because Tony Romo is really, really, really good.
Yeah.
And has always been very good. And the last year or so has been playing at a Hall of Fame caliber level. And it doesn't, you know, you lose Tom Brady, you lose Aaron Rodgers. It's the equivalent to losing Tony Romo right now, the way he's playing. And that is something you just simply don't make up, whether Dez Bryant is or is not in the lineup.
So last thing before we move on to OCC, the two other changes made on the offense are that Elsie Collins is going to get the start at left guard over Leary, and the talk that Christine Michael will get more reps. I'll start with Collins real quick. I think it's time. I think Leary has – Leary clearly doesn't look 100%, and Collins was really impressive when he was in. He had some moments where I think there was that one play where I tweeted out where the team was doing wide left and he decided to do wide right. But other than that, like he was really impressive. He didn't have a lot of mental errors. I think at this point, especially with Leary, I mean, Leary's just not right. His groin is clearly bothering him, and he's playing very weakly. That's the only way to say it.
A guy whose strength is power, and he's suddenly playing without power and snap, then what do you have?
Nothing. And he's getting, like, you know, when they're running wide zone plays, he's not even getting to his targets, and when he is getting to his targets, he's walling them off like a tight end. He's not finishing anybody.
Destroying people last year.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what Collins can do. That's the thing, is that I think Collins actually might be, even when Leary is not injured, I think Collins might be as good as Leary. Because what I went back and saw, what I've watched of his game tape, when he executes a play well, he's fantastic. And he's not screwing up mentally very much from what I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
Where I have some concerns is pass protection, but he was great there. And so I think it's time to at least give him the opportunity and see if he can take it even to another level, which I'm assuming he can, because, you know, he took it to a level we hadn't seen previously once he did get the starts. And so I think it could be a huge shot in the arm for this offensive line, especially running the ball. What do you think?
I agree. I think that it's one of those things where if you're a coaching staff, you look at an injured Leary who has, you know, who will play with some veteran savvy, and you look at a Collins and you say, Collins may make more mistakes now, but who's going to be better by game 12?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, and it might even be a situation in which he's gotten to the point where he may be better by game 6. So you got to go with it. And so the upside and the upside by game 16 or 17, provided he stays healthy and gets all the snaps, et cetera, is significant. And it's time to make the move.
Well, I mean, at 21 years old or 22 years old, however old he is, like, I think he's 21 though. You know, his chance of injury is a lot less than Leary's too. And, you know, I think that's just, besides the fact that Leary has also had a history of lower body injuries.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, in general, younger you are, the more healthy you're likely to stay. Like I said, I wouldn't say this if I wasn't just so incredibly impressed with how much better he played in the game when he started than I expected. I mean, I expected him to be good, but he was better than Larry. Mm-hmm. And I think if you look at, you know, pressures and stats and runs and the drive length of when he was in the game, it bears that out. Like all statistical performance that you can possibly, you know, try to point to offensive line seemed to prove out that Leary was not playing as well as Collins was.
That's right. That's right.
All right. So and then the other news, like we said, was Christine Michael. I think for me, like, I want to see him take all of McFadden's carries. And then maybe like five or six of
Randall's carries.
Randall's carries, yes. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, my brain fell out. I think, you know, I'd like to see them just kind of do an even split between these two. I think they complement each other. I think they can really do some things. And I think, you know, if McFadden isn't going to pass block and is going to run crappy and only get his yards in garbage time versus the Patriots, I'm pretty done with it. You know, I don't really see the need for his presence on the field if the only thing he can have success on is gap power plays and he's not a very good pass protector. I'd like to see Michael and Leary take it from here. Michael and Randall take it from here, and then you know, they signed this kid Rod Smith to the 53, who is also from Seattle. And then, you know, maybe, you know, eventually pepper him in a little bit. I'm kind of done with McFadden. And I think, you know, from what I've seen of Michael, from what I've heard, it sounds like this kid deserves opportunities. And I think they should probably come to the expense of McFadden.
Part of me wonders, I mean, I doubt they'll do this, but
they'll do what I'm saying too.
My dream scenario right now is that Michael gets the start and Joe Randall goes back to the role he had last year in which he really excelled.
I'm totally okay with that too.
I feel like as the change of pace guy, there's something that he really brings in terms of an energy and you know, a kind of quickness and speed. That's a nice change up, right? It's a nice change up to a starter who's basically a guy who, you know, gives you lots of falling forward, dirty yards kind of runs.
Randall's really good at coming off the bench immediately and being good, which I think is kind of a rare talent. Yeah. You see a lot of these running backs who need time, like need a couple carries to get into rhythm. Randall doesn't need that.
In fact, he's almost the opposite of that.
That's exactly what I was going to say. And maybe that what that means is that it does lend himself to be like that B, you know, he needs an A runner and then he's the B guy, you know? So
Now that said, it seems to me that Randall is also in some ways capable of being a third down back. He's actually a pretty good receiver.
Very good catcher, and he's
a better pass blocker than people are willing to give him credit for.
Yes.
And so, you know, when you talk about McFadden, I'll tell you where I've seen McFadden be strong is, you know, there have been several times when they give him the rock multiple times on a drive. That drive against Philadelphia, I think, when you know, it was his turn in the rotation, and he maybe ran five or six times in that drive. And you know, a lot of it was between the tackles. It was late when the Philadelphia defense was tired, and he ran really well. I would actually like to see McFadden be the closer.
Huh.
Yeah. In moments where he's not asked to participate much in the pass game, although he can, right? So, like, you know, if they're trying to close out the game, you don't want to totally eliminate the possibility of a pass, but that, you know, when you're closing out the game, you just say, we're going to line up and we're going to run between the tackles and we're going to, you know, roll over your tired defensive line. And here's our big back who's going to just sort of level his shoulders and he's not going to be asked to cut much. And he's just going to, you know, drive forward and finish. And when he's not asked to cut, and when he's not asked to run, you know, east-west and then cut, he actually can get behind his shoulder pads and deliver a blow, and he's a pretty good runner and a pretty good finisher. He just seems completely incapable when, you know, on sort of outside zone stretch plays to execute that in the way that it's supposed to be. So part of me sort of hopes that ends up being the situation, especially if they use Michael as the kind of the guy who softens the side of beef, and then they can. I'm wondering if McFadden would be interesting as the guy who finishes that off, but I don't know. I do hope though that Michael can do for the offense what the return of Hardy and McClain did for the defense. So, you know, last year we referenced this several times because I think in some ways it was one of our favorite moments from last year's podcast series. The conversation with Mike Fisher, in which he talked about who the new locker room leaders were in the absence of DeMarcus Ware and to some degree Jason Hatcher. And And he had said that at the time it was for the offense, it was Dez Bryant, and for the defense, it was Orlando Scandrick. And then surprisingly enough, his little brother, Rolando McClain. And so Hardy's one of those kind of guys too, right? He's a hard, tough guy. He's, you know, he refuses to back down. He's a competitor, et cetera. He's a dog. And so, you know, this is the Weedem boys crew. And so they got McClain and Hardy back on the defense, and suddenly the defense had a couple of dogs. There's a bunch of guys who are good players, who are you know, guys who will hustle to the whistle, all that kind of stuff, but you need a couple of dogs who really enjoy playing with an edge. And the defense has those guys, and the offense without Bryant is desperate for a similar kind of player. And so what I'm hoping is that Collins might have a little dog to his game. Christian Michael might have a little dog to his game. And I just want a couple of guys in the offense who have that. You know, Jason Witten is the consummate professional. He's a competitive dude. I don't know that he has dog to his game. And I'm not sure that, you know, Beasley or any of those other guys do. And I really love the fact that Collins and Michael might have a little bit of that and might even be able to contribute that to the offensive huddle when and if Bryant comes back.
All right, well, let's get in our resident BTB dog, OCC. But before we do, I want to make sure I plug Blogging the Boys, who is putting on this fine podcast. Blogging the Boys is your one-stop shop for all your Cowboys info about the new starts, about Matt Castle, about the upcoming game against the Giants. Make sure you hit bloggingtheboys.com for all your information. Follow them on Facebook, Blogging the Boys, and on Twitter, at Blogging the Boys.
I am thrilled once again to welcome into the studio the great, the inimitable, the one and only One Cool Customer. Cool, thanks for joining us.
Always nice to be here.
You know, there was an incident that happened in the comments section, I don't know, maybe 3 weeks ago. I had written a news post, and someone went to the comment section and said, "Thanks, OCC, for this terrific post." And actually, you went on and commented in response to that comment and said, "Actually, Rabble Rouser wrote this post." And then someone followed that up by saying, "Oh, well, it doesn't really matter since OCC does all the work that's important on this blog anyway." And I followed that up by saying, you know, I would be offended if it wasn't so true. You know, if you polled every Blogging the Boys front page writer and asked them who their personal favorite among the other FPWs was, I have a feeling that all the ballots would go into one box, the one belonging to One Cool Customer, who combines both quantity. Check this out. He recently eclipsed the 3,200 postmark since joining the front page in February 2010. And quality. He consistently cranks out thought-provoking posts, stat-inflected posts that allow us to look at the game differently. He's certainly my favorite source for outside-the-box Cowboys thinking and has pride of place in my own personal Cowboys pantheon, which, of course, is closely guarded. And in that pantheon, he has a special gilded throne. So I'm thrilled we could once again have him to talk to us about the state of the Cowboys here in the middle of the 2015 season. I thought pretty seriously about calling this the regression to the mean podcast, since it appears that the Cowboys' pendulum in multiple categories, in which they were quite successful in 2014, has in this season swung the other direction. So I'd like to start with what is probably the most impactful of these pendulum swings, which is injuries. Cool. Can you put the injuries we've seen thus far in 2015 into some perspective for us? And how do they compare to, for example, 2014 or perhaps to the two injury-riddled seasons that the Cowboys suffered through in 2012 and 2013?
Okay, I'll start at the very beginning because it's interesting that you mentioned the 2012 and 13 years. If we go back and look at the injury rate in those years, and Football Outsiders has a statistic for that called adjusted gains lost. Okay, which is it's complicated, but the number is fairly simple. How many games did you lose of quality players? And when you look at that over the last 7 years, from 2007 to 2014. The Cowboys were above NFL average just once, And that was exactly in 2012, where they had about 20 more adjusted games lost than the NFL average. Every year in between or before and after, basically, has been at an NFL average. So even last year, even 2013, where we brought in, I don't know, 20 different defensive linemen or something like that, was an average year in terms of injuries. It's really important to keep in mind. The thing that really hurt the Cowboys is the distribution of those injuries, and that's a very different thing. You know, if you lose your entire linebacking core or all your starters on the defensive line, your team is going to look very different, even if the number of injuries overall across the 53-man roster doesn't look as bad. Okay, which brings us to this year. Some of the injuries in quotes, some of the injuries that the Cowboys have had this year are in a way self-inflicted. Randy Gregory, Rolando McClain and Greg Hardy were both suspended. So those are eight games that are missing. But if we assume, graciously assume, that those eight games are injuries or something like that, then the Cowboys have missed as many games this year already as they've missed last year. Okay, and that's a pretty tall order for the first four or five games. Yeah? And that puts into perspective the injuries that they've suffered this year, because it's already at the level of 2014. Now, having said that, some of those guys are coming back. Hardy and McClain were back against the Patriots. Gregory is probably going to come back next week. Tony Romo will come back at some point. And Des Bryant is going to come back. So there is hope, and that makes this season different from last year, because the guys that were missing last year, Sean Lee, Morris Claiborne, Justin Durant, they were gone. They were gone for the season. Mm. But this year, there is hope, at least. The injury toll is very high, but there is hope.
But it seems that hope is dependent upon there not being further injuries.
Yes. Mm. And if you think about where the Cowboys have already suffered injuries, you really hesitate to think where else they could suffer injuries, because there aren't many quality players left who could still get injured. I don't even want to go there, but, you know, we haven't had a significant injury on the offensive line. Jason Witten is still playing. The corners are healthy. The safeties are playing. And those would be the areas you would now look for additional injuries, which you don't want. You don't want at all. So that's the tricky part going forward. Yes, we're getting some people back, but there's always a risk at other positions.
The other angle of this conversation is that what makes this particularly devastating is the salary cap league. And a couple of weeks ago, you authored a post in which you looked at the percentage of each team's cap that is seeing the field. And there are several reasons that teams are paying for players who aren't playing: dead monies, inactive players, practice squatters, and players on IR. Where do the Cowboys stand in each of these categories, especially as it pertains to injuries? And what does it tell us about the 2015 season so far?
So what we see for the Cowboys this year, and I wrote that post about 3 or 4 weeks ago, is that they're only spending something like 58% of their total salary cap on players that are actually playing for them right now, which means that 42% of the total cap charge is not active for the Cowboys. Some of that is in dead money. Some of that is on IR. Some of that was for players that were suspended. Huh. But overall, it means that only half of the team that you tried to put together with your salary cap is actually playing for you. And that's not a good balance. I think they were the worst team, just slightly ahead of the Saints, who were missing Drew Brees at the time. Wow. Other teams like the Bengals, the Jets, the Broncos are playing with about 80 to 90% of their salary cap on the field for them. And that obviously creates a disadvantage. Now, the Cowboys lost Tony Romo, who by himself accounts for something like 20 to 25 million of salary cap space. And when you lose your starting quarterback like that, of course, it impacts your team, but it also impacts the available cap space you're playing with. But when you're handicapped that way and only playing 50% of your team effectively, or the quality of your team, if you equate money or salary cap with quality, then you've got to be in trouble. You have to be in trouble. And the Cowboys are in trouble.
All right. So one of the weekly stats you tend to follow closely is snap counts. And typically, injuries mean certain backups play more snaps than they should. So what patterns or trends have you seen in the snap counts through week five?
Well, what you normally want in a football team is to have your 11 starters playing as many snaps as they possibly can. What we've seen over in normal weeks where there aren't too many injuries, those 11 starters play about 80% of their snaps. Doesn't mean that every single starter plays every 80%. If you look at the defense, the corners play about 100%. The safeties also play almost every snap. The defensive line plays less because there's a rotation going on. Now, as we look at what has happened with the Cowboys this year, instead of the 80% that you would like with your 11 starters, the 11 starters have only played about 54% of the snaps on defense and about 70% of the snaps on offense. So the defense has been hit harder than you would expect if you simply look at the headlines about the Cowboys' injuries, which are all about Tony Romo and Dez Bryant. But the defense has also suffered. It has suffered because Hardy and McClain were not on the field. It has suffered when Lee missed some time due to injury. And elsewhere, the effect on the defense has actually been heavier in terms of backups called to play than it has been on offense.
And I'm assuming then that that's mostly happening along the defensive line. So I guess my question is, are we seeing a situation in which players like Tyrone Crawford, for example, who in many respects has been the lone elite starter remaining on the defensive line in Randy Gregory's absence, playing more and therefore getting quote-unquote worn down? Or is he playing the same and what they're having to do is have someone like Jack Crawford, who they'd prefer to maybe play 20 snaps a game, now playing 40 snaps a game? Or is it a combination of both?
It's a combination of both. I think I remember somewhere that that Rod Marinelli said he wanted his guys to play something like 40 snaps per game. Lawrence is in his high 50s, or was in his high 50s before Hardy came back. And when you look at the game before the Patriots game, the Saints game, they had Crawford taking 40 snaps and Irving, who they just signed off the street, taking 24 snaps. That's almost 2013 level of mm-hmm. awkwardness for a defensive line. When you still have Gregory waiting in the wings, Hardy waiting in the wings, those are the guys you want to play. You don't really want to give Crawford or Irving too many snaps. You know? Give them in relief, sure, but not that many snaps. And that's where the missing starters really hurt you, because you have backups taking snaps, and those backups, as good as they may be, are not at the same level as the starters.
And this, as you said, it reminds us of 2013 when they were a starter forward type of roster. And as soon as the starters went down, they didn't have anyone who could even remotely replicate their performance.
Yeah.
So there are some other statistical measures in which the Cowboys' performance this season has been different than it was in 2014, and has in some ways, or in many ways, declined since the week two win over the Eagles. So I'm wondering if you could discuss the importance of each of these and assess the Cowboys' performance thus far versus both the 2014 season and its great success, as well as what happened over the sort of course of 2015, because it seems like the team we began with is not the team we've been playing with of late. So the first of these is a biggie. I think most people would say it correlates most strongly to winning, and that's turnovers.
Mm-hmm.
So how are they performing differently this year versus 2014, and are we seeing any kind of trend from the beginning of the season to now?
Well, in very simple terms, they're way behind last year in turnovers. What we know is that turnovers are one of the most highly correlated stats that you can have with winning. If you get one turnover more than your opponent, you win about 70% of the time. If you get two more turnovers, it's at 80%, three more, and you win 95% of the games. So it's really important. And this year, they've basically had a couple of turnovers in week two, or takeaways, rather, and that was largely it already. So they're way behind in the turnover department, and that's hurting them in many, many ways. It lengthens the field for the offense, and a guy like Brandon Whedon, if he has to go 80 yards every time, he's just not going to make it. But it also keeps the other guys on the field, and they get to score. So turnovers is one that's really killing them this year, or rather the absence of takeaways on the defense. The Cowboys led were second in the NFL last year with 31 takeaways. This year they have three or four. I don't even know. I don't even keep count. It's so low.
it's three, and they all came in about a 15-minute stretch. And you know, the other funny thing about that is the team that they finished behind last year, Kansas City, is 32nd now. And so there are two teams here that are suffering a pretty significant regression. I guess this is a sort of follow-up to the turnover question. And that is, you know, a lot of people have opined that turnovers are, to varying degrees, a byproduct of random luck. And so is this about, you know, Lady Fortune wreaking her revenge on the Cowboys for being so so generous to them in recent years? Or is this something that they are either doing or not doing? Or is it, as most things are, a combination of both? Do you have a thought about that, or a theory?
I only have a theory. I don't have anything concrete. What you would expect from a team that had 31 turnovers last year, you would expect some regression to the mean. And that's normal, happens every year. But you would expect them to drop to the mean. You wouldn't expect them to drop all the way to the bottom. And so if they were on pace for 15, 16 turnovers this year or takeaways, that would be just fine. That would be expected. But you wouldn't expect them to be on pace for, what is it, 9, 8? Mm-hmm. That's too low. So there has to be some reason for why the takeaways are not there. My assumption is because the pass rush hasn't been there for the first four games, or hasn't been there as much as we'd hoped. It was there in the Patriots game, but they still didn't get any takeaways. So just hang in there. That's really the only message. Hang in there. They will come. They will come. And when they come, they'll come in bunches.
Well, the good news is that it does look like they're forcing turnovers. They're just not finishing them. You know, it's like you see them. You see the situation where Church needs to fall on the fumble, or Mo needs to catch the interception, or, you know what I'm saying? It's so... You know, it's like that. It's like that old thing with Anthony Spencer. He used to call him Almost Anthony until suddenly one day he was doing it, right? So maybe if they can just, you know, focus a little harder, that's all I got. But it does seem like at least the plays, the difficult part is being done. It's just they're not doing the simple thing and like catching the ball, falling on the ball, or, you know, actually completing the play.
Yeah, I think the other example is the ball right in Tyler Patman's breadbasket early in the Saints game, which could have really transformed that game. Okay, so the next kind of quote unquote regression to the mean statistic is third down conversions. So what the heck is going on this year with the Cowboys' third down conversion percentage?
Well, one of the issues is they're not getting what they like to call the manageable third downs as much as they did last year. They're not getting the big runs on first down, and we'll get into that in a second. And on second down, they're not taking any chances, and that's probably, at least from my point of view, that's the biggest issue. They're not converting on second down. Last year, the Cowboys were number two in getting in converting second downs to first downs, number two in the league. And this year, they're number 20, 25, something like that. And the thing here is, if you can't get it done on first down, then you basically have two more chances to get it done. If you're in second and eight, you have to pass. You have to try to get that third down right away. And you have two chances to do that. But if you're going to run again or throw a short completion to get into a manageable third down, then you've wasted the opportunity for a conversion. And that's what the Cowboys did differently last year. They went for it on second down a lot more than they did this year. Now, people have been blaming Brandon Whedon for not pushing it downfield more. Maybe it's also a question of play calling. Linehan has been very, very stubborn in running it on first down. Last year it worked. They just punished the other teams on first down, at least for the early part of the season. But this year it's not working. They're not getting the first down distances. Then on second, they're playing it safe in the hope of playing it safe again on third down. And you play it safe too often, you're not going to win in this league. That's it.
I remember last year there was a kind of important pivotal point when they began to go spread a lot on second down after spending a lot of the early season running on second down to navigate those third and twos, third and threes. And it seems like, you know, a lot of that was let's spread out the defense, and you know, all we have to do is hit one of our underneath guys and get that 5 yards, 6 yards. But that was better than trying to run into an 8 or 9 man box. And
the other thing is, you know, last year the ability of the offense to create made up for a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. They had about the same amount of, I don't know, of penalties, of all the boneheaded plays that they do. But last year, if it was first and 20, yeah, so what? So we complete the pass to the 25. If it's third and 18, well, throw it to Terrence Williams. He'll get inbounds. You know, it's a very, very different team right now. If it's third and 5, you're worried because you don't know that they can get somebody open beyond that 5 yard line. Whereas last year they just said, you know, heck, we'll go for it. It's third and 18, no problem. We'll convert, and that's a major shift.
I'd go get a beer at third and 5. It'd be so boring last year. It'd be like, exactly. Oh, we got this one.
Yeah.
Even if the third and 18, like you said, it's easy to convert. That is the big difference, is the confidence level at which, you know, you feel, and you feel it too. It's like, are they going to be able to convert a third and 2, a third and 1? I mean, like, what are they, like 1 and 4, like 2 and 4 on third and 1s this year? I mean, it's crazy, like the level of third down conversion to me has been the place where I've noticed the most large gap between when we had even just Dez and but without both Romo and Dez, it's been just unbelievably different offense.
Correct. Yeah.
And it seems like their inability to establish real positive yardage to, as you were saying earlier, OCC, to punish rivals on first down, even when there are eight man boxes, because, you know, several people have pointed out it's not like last year everybody was so terrified of Dez on first down that they were, you know, putting their safeties 30 yards deep. Everyone knew that the Cowboys wanted to run on first down. They put 8 men in the box, and the Cowboys just said, okay, fine, and muscled out 4 or 5 yards. Mm-hmm. And their complete inability to do the same thing this year, I think, has put a degree of fear, trepidation, concern, whatever you want to call it, in the minds of the offensive coaching staff. And so they're so much less willing to call a kind of just like, you know, strength on strength, brute force against brute force, you know, run between the tackles on third and one. Yeah. So it seems like what they're trying to do on third and one, third and two is to trick the other team, or to, you know, get to the perimeter or do something like that, as opposed to just go to pure power.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the next thing I want to talk about that seems to have fallen off from last year, when the team, because of their ability in many ways to punish the opposition, to pile up significant differentials in terms of plays run or time of possession, is the sort of fourth quarter point differential, which seems to have fallen off considerably from 2014's performance. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, the Cowboys this year, and I haven't factored in the Patriots game yet, but that went the same direction again, have given up the second highest number of points of any team in the league in the fourth quarter. In fact, almost half of the points they've given up this year came in the fourth quarter. And that's telling for a number of reasons. One, we've also seen that the offense can't stay on the field. Mm-hmm. Never more so than in the Patriots game. Of course, the Patriots are a good team, so it shouldn't have come as that big a surprise. But over the course of the season already, the offense wasn't getting enough snaps, and the defense, in turn, had to compensate for that, played more snaps. That means guys are tired in the fourth quarter, and when you don't have the quality starters in there in the first place, Gregory, Hardy, McClain, the other McClain as well, you're just missing too much quality, and you can only hold on for so long before the opposition just overwhelms you. And that's happening for the Cowboys in the fourth quarter. Didn't happen last year. They went in the fourth quarter with the lead most of the time last year anyway. But this year, they're just hemorrhaging points in the fourth quarter.
You know, one of the interesting stats from the Patriots game was the Cowboys had 8 drives in the first half. And, mm-hmm. and you know, last year with them, particularly early in the season, with them chewing up, you know, 5 minutes per drive, 7 minutes per drive, 10 minutes per drive sometimes, 8 drives was a game's worth. And so mm-hmm. if you flip that to the defense, you know, the expectations for the defense in 2014 were that they would have to defend between 7 and 9 drives. Mm-hmm. And if we think about that against New England, you know, assuming 2014's offense, which of course is a huge assumption, but assuming that, then we're talking about a defense that gives up 13 points for the game.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty special sauce. And against the Patriots, that's a damn fine performance. But as you said, you know, how long can an undersized defense that relies on playing really, really hard with their hair on fire, how many drives can we ask them to sustain that? And I think the fourth quarter performance is suggesting that it's not as many drives as we're asking them to do now. a couple more interesting stats. Like the next one I'd like to talk about is, and this is something that is dear to I think both you, but certainly I know to Rod Marinelli, is the Aikman efficiency rating. So what are those all about, and what's going on with the Cowboys vis-a-vis that particular rating metric this season?
Okay, the Aikman ratings are a combination of a number of different stats, points, turnovers, red zone efficiency, third down conversions, basically all the important stats that you have in football. They're combined into one single number. The Cowboys were at the very top of that Aikman rating last year, not at the very top, but in the top 5. This year, they're somewhere in the low 20s. And if you look at especially at the defense, the main reason is the third down conversion percentage. Similar issue to the offense, except this time it's the defense. They're allowing too many third downs and the absence of turnovers, which is also closely linked to third down conversion. No turnovers or no takeaways, and then they're not doing so well. But there is hope, again, in this number because the yards per attempt the Cowboys defense is actually a top 10 unit, and very few people realize that. Very few people want to realize that. But we're a top 10 unit in terms of yards per pass attempt, we're 9th, and yards per rush attempt, we're 6th. So on a per play basis, we're holding the opponent to low gains, but we're not getting them off the field. They're converting too many third downs, and we're not getting any takeaways. The first inkling that could change was obviously against the Patriots. Ravel, you just mentioned the 8 first half drives. Well, the defense did brilliantly on those 8 drives, getting a lot of 3-and-outs, frustrating the Patriots to no end. That's the defense that's going to do really well in this Aikman rating if they can get a couple of takeaways.
Mm. And not only that, but you know, 2 of the Patriots' scores came on drives where they only had to drive the ball 15 yards because they were winning the field position battle because the offense was basically getting no yardage or even losing yardage on drives. Mm-hmm. So if the offense can do anything to help the you know the sort of field position exchange, I think we'll see those numbers even improve. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you were talking about their you know the yards that they're allowing per pass, and this is in some ways related to our last statistical metric, which of course you've called famously the Robitussin of stats, and that's and that's passer rating differential. So what's going on both in terms of comparison to last year, but also over the course of this year, the trajectory from the beginning to the 5th game in terms of the Cowboys passer rating differential?
Okay. So we've seen over the last few years that passer rating differential is highly correlated to winning in the NFL. Highly correlated. It's one of the stats that's most highly correlated. And it's interesting because it just looks at the passing game in isolation. Doesn't account for the running game. Doesn't account for special teams. But just the passing game itself is so highly correlated to winning that you know the passer rating differential expresses that. Unfortunately for the Cowboys this year, they have a negative passer rating differential. Mm. The defensive passer rating is too high. Also, again, because there are no takeaways, a couple of takeaways, and that would look very, very different. Because, as I said, the yards per attempt are fine. They're allowing touchdowns. They're not taking takeaways. It's bad for your defensive passer rating. On offense, Well, not much is happening. We have a couple of TDs. We have a couple of interceptions. But overall, the passer rating is in the 90s, which is an okay passer rating. But the Cowboys are not able to generate a positive passer rating differential. I think last year they were at 16. Romo had a, I don't even know what his passer rating was last year, 116 or 108, an incredible number. And that's not happening this year. The offense is not bailing out the defense in the passer rating department, and that's a big issue. We're not passing the ball well enough, and the offense is not generating enough takeaways.
And I think one of the things to be pointed out is that after two games, the Cowboys had a very impressive passer rating differential. And, yes, you know, in the post in which you first brought up this this particular stat, you noticed, or you included a kind of equation where you can translate loosely the the differential into wins and losses for the season. And so there was a moment there after the second game when they had just completely shut down the passing game of the Eagles, in which their passer rating differential translated roughly to almost 13 wins, just short of 13 wins, which was which was pretty awesome. And since then it's completely fallen off the cliff. And so their current passer rating differential, I think, translates to something like 6 wins. Exactly. And so that's quite a fall from grace, as it were.
Which actually conveniently leads me to the next question, which is to say that it's convenient to say the Cowboys were flying along until Romo got hurt, but certainly the team played better the first 2 weeks and not as well since then, which kind of allows us to place blame squarely on Brandon Weeden. But it's not like the team was all well when the team was 2-0. Were there statistical signs of the current 0-3 fall from grace present, even before Brandon Weeden took over under center?
Yeah, well, the first one and the most obvious one is the relative inability of the offense to score points. The points scored against the Giants were extremely hard to come by, and even against Philly, they only scored 20 points in those first two games. So the offense wasn't clicking at all. Tony Romo had a good passer rating, a very good passer rating, but in other areas of the field, they weren't doing so well. They weren't completing drives the way they had done the last year. That was the first inkling that something was wrong. Then they had the Eagles game with the 3 turnovers, but they didn't have any against the Giants, and that just continued. So the early warning signs were there. An offense that was not yet in sync, and a defense that was not that was, to use the phrase from earlier in the podcast, regressing to the mean in the takeaway department. Mm.
So I want to talk a little bit more about the offense now. Bird Dog 26, who's a BTB friend and a friend of our podcast, has said that in league circles, Linehan's offense has been known as being star dependent. You know, when he was with Detroit, he really relied on his quarterback, his big name receiver, his running backs, et cetera, and that he leans on his stars more than perhaps other offensive coordinators do. And we certainly saw this last season when Tony Romo, Dez Bryant, and DeMarco Murray all had huge seasons. I remember in particular the second half of the first Giants game. If you guys remember that game, it was the Giants game that was in Dallas, and New York had played them pretty evenly in the first half. And the second half, he seemed to just say, you know what, I'm not going to go to Beasley. I'm not really even going to go to Witten much. I'm going to go to Dez and feed the ball to Murray. And in fact, those three guys took over the game and they extended the lead and won the game. And this seems to be in some ways indicative of the way that Linehan likes to win. So OCC, early last season, you wrote a post in which you looked at what you called big game performances, which are, essentially 300-yard passing days, 100-yard rushing and receiving days, and as a kind of important statistical marker. So thinking about that and thinking about Bird Dog's comment about Linehan, what I'm wondering now is whether this reliance on stars makes an offense more vulnerable when one, or in this case two or three of them, are no longer with the team or out of the lineup. So, and now that we've had a chance to think about this for a while, what are your thoughts in this regard?
Well, I think any team in the league, if you take away their quarterback, their star wide receiver, and their star running back, will struggle badly. I mean, what we're seeing with the Cowboys is probably just the average of how bad it can get. It can get a lot worse than has happened. So I'm a little bit, I don't know. With no disrespect to Bird Dog, but I think every team is star dependent. That's why they are stars. Or think about it the other way. When Linehan came to Dallas, DeMarco Murray was not a star. DeMarco Murray was a running back with a lot of question marks. The Cowboys were one of the worst teams in the league at running the ball after the 2013 season. Nobody thought anything would happen on the ground in Dallas. And Linehan came in and changed that. So you could say he relied on those three, just as Jimmy Johnson did during his Super Bowl runs. But I think every team has those big three, or has to have some element of those big three to succeed. And if they're gone, if all of three of them are gone, and then their backups are gone too, like Lance Dunbar, then you're in so much trouble.
All right, so final question. What I wonder is how important this next game against the Giants in New York will be statistically. Historically, there must be a difference between 2-4 and 3-3 teams in terms of what percentage they make the playoffs. If we look at this, how much will winning or losing on Sunday actually impact the Cowboys' playoff chances?
Okay. Next Sunday is a huge, huge, huge game for the Cowboys.
Wow, this is three huges, people. Wow. Three.
This is as close to a must-win game as we can get. And in fact, if we look at I've tracked the percentages of playoff odds by week for every single possible record that you can have. And the difference between 2-4 and 3-3 is the highest of any record through the first six
wow.
games.
Wow.
At 2-4, your chances of making the playoffs, or historically, since the realignment in 2002, the chances of making the playoffs with a 2-4 record are 7%. If you're at 3-3, it's 37%. So there's a 30-point swing in playoff odds for the Cowboys waiting for them. It's the biggest swing of any possible record combination of the first 6 weeks of the season. And when you step back and think about it, if you assume that something like a 10-6 record will get you into the playoffs, in the East this year, that might win the division outright. But as a wild card, 10-6 is probably what you need to get into the playoffs. If you're really lucky, 9-7, but let's stick with 10-6. If you're a 2-4 team, that means you have to play the remaining games with an 8-2 record. If you're a 2-4 team, you're a bad team anyway. I mean, you can have all sorts of excuses. Yeah, my quarterback is not here and Des Bryant is not here. But 2-4 is a sucky team. And to expect a team from 2-4 to go to 8-2 for the remaining of the season, that's a really tall order. And only 6 of 84 teams have managed that. At 3-3, picture is a little bit different. Now you only need a 7-3 record. 7-3 record, That's not completely out of the question. And as you look at the remaining schedule of the Cowboys, there are probably two really tough games left on the schedule. And the others are, they can win them, they can lose them, but they're not impossible to win. So getting to that 3-3, apart from all the divisional implications of winning against the Giants, but the 3-3 is something you have to get. Otherwise, your playoff chances go up in the smoke.
Wow, I had no idea it was going to be that extreme. That's really interesting. Before I remind all the listeners and where they can find you and your great work, I just want to remind everyone that we're going to have the BTB meetup in the beautiful Poconos Mountains for next week's game against the Giants. This huge, huge, huge game against the Giants, and I'll be there, and OCC will be there as well. So. Cool. When are you actually flying to the States?
I'm flying in on Wednesday. We're going to spend a couple of days in Washington, sightseeing, doing the tours there. I even have tickets to tour the Congress. So we're set up, and then we'll join you guys up at Mount Poconos on Saturday night, and then watch the games on Sunday.
Excellent, excellent. So if you haven't already signed up for that, please do. It's going to be an awesome time. You can meet OCC, and you can meet his son, Young CC, as well. And And I just want to remind everyone to follow OCC and his fine, fine work on Blogging the Boys. You know, every post that he writes teaches me something about the game that I didn't know before. And he's a great follow on Twitter. He's not the most frequent tweeter, but whenever he does, it's usually something of tremendous gravitas and insight. And his handle is at OCC44. That's at OCC44. Cool. Please come back and join us again sometime. Talk Cowboys, will you?
I will. And thanks for having me, guys.
It's been a pleasure.
Well, fantastic stuff from the Goog, as always. It's always great to have OCC on. We want to make sure that we plug Blogging the Boys, who put on this podcast. BloggingTheBoys.com is your one-stop shop for all Cowboys information about the coming weeks, about the injuries, about updates of what's going on with the game planning for the week against the Giants. Make sure you're hitting BloggingTheBoys.com for all that good stuff. And follow them on Facebook, Blogging the Boys, and on Twitter, at Blogging the Boys. And until next week, everybody, happy trails.
Happy trails, y'all.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling. Who cares about the clouds when we're together?
Just sing a song and bring the sunny weather.
Happy trails to you.